Hey, how's it going? This is the Football Diary Podcast. I'm Mike here with Dave and Miles on International Week, where Scotland qualified for Euro 2024 after Spain beat Norway. Jordan Henderson got booed in a friendly, plus a look ahead to England, Italy. Gambling in football as well. Do we have a crisis there as Italy stars face investigation? And Sheikh Jassim pulls out of buying Manchester United, leaving a full takeover looking unlikely. And many questions for Manchester United fans to ask around the whole takeover situation now. So let's start with Scotland, who are understandably celebrating after qualifying for Euro 2024. Massive achievement, especially when you consider they've won five and lost one out of the six games they've played. The same record as Spain. Even though Scott McTominay had what looked like an absolute wonder strike disallowed, Miles, they still go through. It was fair the goal was disallowed. Bit of a shame, mind you. But Scotland qualifying for a major tournament, that's big news, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge. But to be honest, I think it's about par for the course, because I think we underestimate Scotland quite a bit, actually. When you look at this squad, it's one of the most talented Scotland squads I've seen in my lifetime, for sure. Steve Clarke's an excellent coach, a really, really good manager as well. And he's got them really well organised, and he's built a really good culture around that team. And we've seen that across the kind of British countries in particular. Maybe we see that more because we're kind of at hand with the home nations a bit more, so it's easier coverage. But it feels like Scotland is a really united camp at the moment. And we saw how far that took someone like Wales before. We saw that be the kind of bedrock of England's success for a while as well. And this Scotland team seems to be emulating that now, because people seem to go to Scotland and in their international duty and just thrive. Like, I look at someone like McGinn, for example, who, when he was really struggling for club form under Gerrard, would go to Scotland and just bag at least a goal every game. So you see that these players actually really appreciate being part of that camp. And it's a really talented camp as well. So it's an excellent achievement for them. But let's not forget, this is a team that's in Group A in the Nations League now. It's not a new thing that Scotland are good. And it's thoroughly deserved that they're there. It's not some sort of lucky qualification. This was a difficult group. And they've essentially knocked Erling Haaland and Martin Ødegaard out of the Euros. And we know that that seems like a big statement, doesn't it?
Massive statement, yeah. I think even going toe-to-toe with Spain, Dave, up to this point, will be seen as a huge achievement. And whether they'll finish top of the group now, we don't know, because there's a couple of tough games still to go. And I think Spain's running looks a little bit easier than Scotland's. But even to finish second would have been unthinkable, really, at the start of the campaign. So, understandably, thrilled. How did Scotland get there, do you think?
I think it definitely coincides. If you have a look at some of their main players, particularly this season, there's some of their players having outstanding seasons and domestically. Obviously, look at Billy Gilmore. He's really kind of grown into his role, obviously, at Brighton as well, and stepping into there, he's doing really well. And Miles mentions McGinn. Since, obviously, Emery's come in, he's been absolutely outstanding. And it seems like a lot of these players have carried their club form into them. We mentioned, obviously, Aaron Hickey, who's doing really well at Brentford, obviously, unfortunately, injured now. Robertson, Liverpool. And Callum McGregor, who's, you know, such a great player for Celtic. And I just think what they've done is obviously outstanding, the achievement. But I also feel as though there's areas in that team that they can continue to improve. I think you mentioned there they've got, obviously, a couple more games. I think the big thing is they're qualified now. There's, you know, I think a bit of relief there in terms of the pressure. They've obviously had some untimely injuries. Obviously mentioned Robertson and Hickey have both had, looks like they've had a couple of bad injuries, which isn't obviously ideal, but it's probably come at the right time for them, really. Obviously now they've qualified. But it also gives opportunities to some of the younger players that are going to come in. And I definitely think they probably need to look more in the attacking areas. Obviously, there's mentions about players who are switching allegiances. Obviously, the mentions of Harvey Barnes, Elliot Anderson's another one we've mentioned as well. But I do feel like they need to get a source of goals probably from elsewhere. They've been a little
bit... machine Scott McTominay. Come on.
Oh, obviously, you know, he's been absolutely outstanding in this campaign with his, you know, his input in terms of goals. But I do like Shea Adams, but I just feel like they need something else in there, and whether they can find that that source of goals from elsewhere. I think it's a lot to go into a major competition relying on just Scott McTominay, despite the saviour that he's been, you know, many a time, particularly in, you know, for club and country of late. But it's exciting, obviously. You know, it's the last few years we mentioned before this that it was probably, you know, Ireland and Wales. It's been a long time since Scotland have been in this position. And really, I think you saw it against England. It feels like they've got a real head of steam building around the momentum that they're carrying at the moment, and I think that's why you want them to finish strong in this qualifying okay, they've qualified, but if they can get a couple of wins out of these last two games, that'd be excellent for them.
It's difficult to know what Scotland's level is as well, because they've only been tested a few times in the last year or so, obviously against England, which had nothing riding on it necessarily, but England kind of dealt with them quite comfortably. And obviously the game against Spain earlier in the week, they lost. Again, small margins because McTominay's goal was disallowed. But Miles, if you're looking at Scotland's team and the squad now and you think about Euro 2024, what would you say is a realistic ambition for them? Because, you know, it's a big tournament now, isn't it? Do you reckon they've got a chance of progressing past the group stages at least?
That would be huge for them, because I think it would be the first time in their history that they managed to do that as well. So what an achievement that would be. But yeah, I think they have been tested, to be honest. That we've seen them get a result against Spain already in this qualifying and Norway. So I think it's really easy to kind of underestimate what the qualifying process has done. But you saw them rise up through the Nations League as well. So this is a consistent thing. And the adaptability of someone like Steve Clarke, who is quite a defensive coach, actually, but has looked at someone like McTominay, for example, and moved into a more attacking position and seen real benefits for it. Let's not forget that when they were in their last qualifying campaign, McTominay was playing as like a centre-back as part of a back five. Yeah. So to move him up the pitch shows that Clarke is identifying what the strengths in that squad are really well now. And the squad is very good. As a midfield, I think they're really, really strong. And yeah, the Spain game was quite fine margins. There are a lot of opportunities for Spain, and Alvaro Morata will miss a lot of opportunities. You know that. So it was a shame for them to lose it, but I think it was probably a fair result in the end. But like Dave says, they just want to ride this wave now and carry the momentum into the tournament. And with the new format, it'll all depend on the luck of the draw, really. But they could easily get out of the group. And then you never know. Once it gets to knockout football, the culture around your team is such a big part of it. We saw that with Wales getting to the semi-finals. On paper, they're not as talented a squad as some of the bigger European nations that we're used to as footballing names. But when they've got the kind of footballing nous and kind of know-how that midfield has got, and a coach like Steve Clarke, a company with a really harmonious dressing room, they could go, who knows where they could get to in the Euros. But I wouldn't write them off by any stretch.
I don't think we were. No, I was just playing devil's advocate there. Yeah, you never know. No, I think Scotland have got a great chance too, to be honest. And it's good to see the fans have something to cheer about, because being a Scotland fan's been a miserable time for the last two or three decades, hasn't it? I remember Euro 96, they seemed to be like one of the better squads in the UK, you know, and England were doing well at that point. But since then, it's been a pretty dry run, hasn't it?
Do you think there'll be a few players tempted to switch allegiance now, then it obviously Scotland qualify?
Yeah, why not?
It's not a once-in-a-lifetime thing. They've got a generational thing now where for maybe two or three tournaments, they could have a decent squad to compete. So, yeah, of course.
Well, they did it last time, didn't they? The last time they qualified, that's when Adams moved over, for example.
Yeah.
And you feel a bit harsh that in qualified, and then other players that you think might be slightly better go in, oh, yeah, I'll have a bit of that. But if they could get someone like Harvey Barnes, like we've mentioned a few times, that would be huge, because he's an excellent footballer. He's really, really good. But Elliot Anderson would be a bigger one for me because of his age profile. That's someone that they're getting in for the long term then. And we don't really know what his ceiling is yet. So it's difficult. I never really know where to stand with these kinds of conversations, because I'm not someone who has dual nationality, really. So it's interesting to know what it means to the player, because sometimes the opportunity to play at a major tournament is enough of a leading factor. But sometimes your connection to your family is the thing. So who knows what some of these players will be thinking. But it looks like a camp I'd want to be a part of if I had the opportunity to. So why not?
I think you only have to look at, obviously, past experiences. Like, for instance, Wilf Zaha, obviously, you know, he did make an appearance for England. And then younger players, I think, be looking at sort of instances like that and probably thinking, well, do I actually want to sort of, you know, ponder whether I'm actually going to make the squad again, or am I going to take action and, you know, obviously switch allegiances. I think there are instances of that. And if you only have to look at the competition in that England squad, it's, you know, it's as strong as it's been for a very long time. And I just feel as though there's obviously some opportunities there, I think, especially in that squad. We mentioned, obviously, in the attacking areas, they probably are crying out for a couple of players with a bit more sort of bit more pedigree and a bit more decisiveness in the right areas.
Well, you contrast the cheers of the Scotland fans with the boos from some of the England fans in their recent game against Australia, where it seems being talented and informed doesn't necessarily guarantee you a place in the England squad either. I think that's where it's part of the reason why Jordan Henderson received boos from the England fans. I know Gareth Southgate's very quick to defend Henderson's inclusion, saying he's a role model to the rest of the squad, etc. But I mean, if we're talking pure football, guys, I'll start with you, Miles, first of all. Jordan Henderson's not playing anywhere near the quality that deserves to be in the England squad or get any international recognition, I don't think. I don't think his form's been that great either, from what I've heard. I've not seen him play live, but I'm not hearing rave reviews. So why is he in the England squad? What do we learn from including him in this friendly? And if you were in the stands as well, would you be booing him too?
Would I be booing him is a very interesting question. I do understand what Southgate says when he says it's not productive to boo any of our players, but also some of that responsibility lies on Southgate to not pick him, because there aren't enough, in my mind. Look, Southgate knows more about football than me. I don't doubt, but I can't understand the inclusion of Jordan Henderson on any level, because we just talked about the benefit that Scotland have of that harmonious dressing room, and England really had that for a long time. The last thing you want to do is turn your fans against anyone in the squad. And when you've got a player who, obviously, there are other reasons that the England fans are really disheartened with him, and we'll go into that, I'm sure. But even from just a playing capacity, you say he's not currently playing at that level. There's an argument to say he's not been playing at the sort of standard that we need for an England midfielder, even at the back end of his Liverpool career as well. I wouldn't have had Henderson in my last squad, let alone this one. So I do find it difficult to see him playing still. It doesn't really make sense to me why they played him this friendly, other than to test the waters. I feel like that's what Southgate was kind of doing, to see what the fan response would be towards him. I understand that you want leaders in the team, but I feel like that leadership can come from so many other places. You've got quite a well-established squad now. And the selection as a whole was just very odd. There were some that I was really happy with. It was really nice to see people like Colwill and Tomori and Bowen, and obviously for me, Watkins get minutes. And then like Sam Johnstone plays in goal ahead of Aaron Ramsdale when you've got an opportunity to try and give him a game. And let's be honest, long term, who's going to be England's number one? It's going to be either Pickford or Ramsdale. So it's very odd selection as a whole, but it's a friendly. I don't want to read too much into that. It's just a shame that the whole talking point from this game afterwards was Jordan Henderson's inclusion.
Yeah.
Because the football was really poor. The fan response was poor. And the team selection was poor. So I don't really know what else to take from it. It's not what you want going into a really crucial qualifying game.
Yeah. It's interesting though, because England fans, even though England are doing really well in qualifying, better than Scotland, we haven't lost a game. We haven't lost the game, you know. We've drawn to Ukraine, and that drew a lot of criticism as well. We've just won a friendly, and that's all it is, a friendly. We've experimented a lot, and I think we've always been saying to Gareth Southgate, stop playing it so safe and give players a chance. He's done that. So why that one is, Dave? You've got to look at that game and go, yeah, it was probably going to be a bit of a slog because there were so many changes, probably too many in some ways, but that inclusion of Henderson seems to have dominated everything, which is really disappointing. So why include him, and what's your thoughts on it, mate?
Yeah, I can't ever say I'd boo a player, you know, especially, obviously, you know, your own country. I don't agree with it. But I can understand fans' frustration, especially, obviously, the decision that he's made going over there, and the sort of, you know, the moral sort of background behind it. As well.
Not just going there, but the advocacy as well recently.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it does annoy me. It annoys me that it's still making headlines, because it's been going on for a while now, hasn't it? And it's not been the first time, obviously, the player's been booed. Obviously, we had Maguire recently as well, who's still getting booed as well. But I don't know how you can take any of Southgate's decisions. I don't know how you can rationalise him, because we've seen that he's been a bit of a hypocrite at times in terms of obviously his excuses that he's made, particularly about players, him not playing players who aren't getting enough team football when he's continuing to play Maguire over and over. Obviously, Henderson's not playing.
And Phillips.
Yeah, again. And Phillips as well, who's arguably he's had even less football than Maguire. So you've got a question, really, why is... And I don't think it's protecting the player at all. There's obviously a lot been going on at the minute about, obviously, around Henderson. And it's just a real sort of lack of duty of care for me. I don't feel like it's doing him many favours at the minute.
I think when you look at the whole Beckham documentary, which I'm sure you've all seen as yeah. well, the effect that abuse has on players, and, you know, Beckham, you know, he got sent off in the World Cup. He didn't harm anybody, do you know what I mean? It was an innocent young man making a mistake. And the amount of abuse he got was a real eye-opener to see his take on it. We talk about mental health in football a lot, don't we? And I'm not going to say I agree with Jordan Henderson's inclusion, but I'm with you, Dave. I don't know how I'd ever be compelled to boo a player at a football game, especially one that plays for the team I support.
I think as well, you look at, you know, we mentioned midfielders that are doing well in the league at the minute. Obviously, you know, James Ward-Prowse is probably the main one, really, who's you know, having a great season. I think it's mainly because there's so many players that are probably much more deserving of an opportunity than Jordan Henderson, who's clearly not the future of English football, especially at his age. I mean, I don't think you particularly liked him anyway, Miles, even when he was a little, obviously a lot younger. You've probably not been his biggest fan, but...
I'll give you that idea,
I don't get
Dave.
It.
I don't, yeah, I don't understand the reason for it, to be honest.
Do you know what? I'm on the fence of, I don't really want to criticise anyone for booing him either, because I wouldn't do it, I don't think. I don't think it is productive, but I also understand that you're kind of being forced into a position where if you have a strong moral feeling towards it, what else are you supposed to do? Because you don't want to get to a point where you just stop supporting the country. Like, that feels mad, because that's a team that has been built for you, it feels like. Southgate really did a really good job of giving England fans hope and buy into what he was building again. And it feels like he's losing that really, really fast. It tells me a couple of things, his inclusion. It tells me that the next tournament will be Southgate's last, absolutely, because there's no reason to keep Jordan Henderson in if you're building for the future. Because if Southgate saw himself doing the next couple of tournaments, he'd want to look at someone of a younger profile in these occasions. But it tells me that actually he thinks he can get Henderson through the next Euros. It's tried and tested for him, and then he's going to go anyway, and it's someone else's problem. I think we learn that. I also think we learn a bit about the kind of nature of Henderson, because I think a lot of players probably would have retired when they made that move. We've seen it so many times across international football. How many times have we seen someone make a move to a league that's kind of outside Europe's top five and then go, all right, and because I'm that far and I'm not at that standard, I haven't really got the capacity to be available for international selection anymore. And maybe you can commend him on that, that he still wants to be available if he's picked. But I just think then you save everyone a few problems. And if Southgate believes that Henderson really is good for the younger players and really is a role model, well, he could still do that and not be part of the squad. He could still represent something really strong. He could still be the kind of person who talks with the players. Saka has been at this training camp, despite the fact that he's not in the squad and injured, because he still wants to be around the place. I don't doubt that Henderson could still play that role if he really wanted to, and it was all about influencing a younger generation. But right now, you've got a player who has clearly upset a lot of the fans with the way he's aligned himself and the way he's conducted himself. We've got a player who isn't really playing at the right sort of level and also isn't of the right standard to this team. There is no rationale other than a bit of stubbornness from Southgate, I think, to persevere with it. And also a case of very short-term thinking. Because, all right, Ward-Prowse isn't the youngest player, but Dave's right, is in a better vein of form, could be in that squad and could have a look at him, brings a lot more to England. Or we could completely change the midfield system, which I think seems the most logical setup, and play one holding midfielder and get a more creative player in over Henderson. That makes a lot of sense. Or give someone like Jacob Ramsey a go and just see what happens there. But there's no logical reason to include Henderson when you consider he doesn't bring enough from a footballing point of view, and he's upsetting the fans and creating a bit of disharmony going into another tournament. And that's the last thing England need. Southgate's got enough people on his back.
I think the way you look at it is, should he be starting in any England team in the biggest games? The answer is no. And would you be comfortable bringing him off the bench in one of the biggest games for England in a major tournament? No. The answer is no as well. So,
but everything, it's difficult because the whole thing's surrounded by hypocrisy, isn't it? Because Henderson himself is deemed a hypocrite by the England fans for the stance that he previously took and where he is now. Southgate's been a bit of a hypocrite by calling him a role model and then seeing what he now stands for and saying that he doesn't understand why people are booing him, but he knows the exact reasons why people are booing him. fans to a degree are hypocritical. If this was Harry Kane, would fans boo his inclusion in the England squad? I don't know. And the nature of football and football fandom means that actually a lot of the time, the majority of the people that were in that crowd booing Henderson are joining in from a mob mentality kind of point of view. And actually, we don't know what they're talking about on social media, the way they're conducting themselves around these issues. They're probably just as bad, if not worse, some of them. But it's just a difficult environment to manage. And really, the smart thing to do is not create that environment by not including the player that's going to be so divisive, because there's no need.
It was similar with Maguire, wasn't it? Obviously, he was having a really tough time for England. But obviously, he still selected him. And obviously, he made that mistake on international duty as well. And he got absolutely battered. I feel like it was just a misreading of the situation from Southgate, not actually just taking the player out of the limelight. It's similar again, to be honest.
I think the contrast between Henderson and then alongside a young, dynamic Jude Bellingham as well, and the energy between the two and the age, and you know, one's the future of English football and the other one just looks like, you know, something from the past, very much from the past, doesn't it? Makes me realise that it's just not the quality anymore. You know, you need a player like Jude Bellingham, who's absolutely world class, and then the same midfield, you've got Jordan Henderson next to him. It just makes no sense at all. So it's an odd one for me, really odd.
Mike, you mentioned that you thought there were too many changes. I really agree with that, because I feel like the point of making changes and introducing new players is to see how they fit a system. Realistically, of the 11 who played against Australia, how many of them do you see playing the Italy game or a game at the Euros? And would it not have made more sense? And I understand that injury kind of stopped that with like Saka. You know, Saka's going to be on the team sheet. He wasn't there. But would we not have seen more of like what Watkins is made of if we'd played a normal England forward line? Or Bowen, for example, just one of them, rather than changing all four. Maybe Grealish stays, but the rest of them, do you not think that actually it's quite counterproductive to make that many changes, because now you don't know how they fit into England's system still? We basically played a B team.
No, it's literally a change of players for the sake of changing players in some ways. And I think the only thing we did learn is that Ollie Watkins is now the most definite backup to Harry Kane.
You know? Do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think with Ivan Toney's issues, you know, which we'll touch on in a moment, to be fair, and that kind of the gambling issue in football, I do think Ollie Watkins, in form that he's in as well, is the definite kind of backup to Kane. If not, if we ever switch to a front two, I think him and Kane would complement each other pretty well as well. So
yeah, I do.
We've learned that about Watkins. I think we knew it anyway, but I think Southgate probably needed some convincing. Other than that, though, maybe the fact that Tomori's been given a chance at centre-backs, progress, I guess.
I mean,
do you know what? Go on, Dave, sorry.
Watkins might be taking Rashford's place at this rate.
Yeah, do you know what? Yeah, that's kind of what I was about to say. In terms of the Watkins conversation, I do think that I can't really understand why he's been overlooked quite as much. So it was something like 560 days since his last international game and goal, by the way. And he's got an excellent record. I think since Emery took over, he's had the third most goal involvements in the Premier League. He's scored more goals than any other English forward in the last three seasons, or something ridiculous, other than Harry Kane. And he'll probably catch that within this season because Kane's gone. But it's mad to me that there's even debate about it. Now, I understand that Ivan Toney had a phenomenal season last year, but I think he's probably burnt a few bridges with the FA with some of the comments he's made, and we'll come to that later, I'm sure. Callum Wilson's an excellent finisher and has always done well for England, but you know his injury record's not great. Same could be said of Tammy Abraham. Eddie Nketiah is quite untested. And then you've got someone like Watkins, who has come on leaps and bounds under Unai Emery and has become a real striker again. I think he's really found his goal-scoring form. We've all seen that. He's performing at a really high level. He's consistently selected. There's no debate about whether he gets into the Aston Villa starting 11, whereas someone like Wilson maybe is going to miss games here and there to Isak. And actually, I think it's quite slept on how good England's striking options are. Because Kane is so good, you don't really look behind that. But how many international sides would kill for one of those strikers right now? And Watkins does seem to have really kind of elevated himself to the top of that pecking order. And he made some really interesting comments after the game about how he doesn't really just want to be an understudy to Harry Kane. He wants to prove that he can contribute to this England camp because they are such different players.
Yeah.
If Kane got injured and we had to play Watkins, it would change the way that England play a lot. I do agree with that. And that might be why someone like Ivan Toney gets more of a look in, because he's a bit more like for like. But You are right, Mike. I'd love to see them together. Because Kane,
I think so.
As particularly as Kane is getting older, he likes to drop deep, he likes to look for a ball in behind. And that is exactly what Watkins likes to capitalise on. And he mentioned that. He said that Harry's strengths were dropping deep and his were getting in behind goals. So why not try them together? And if you're struggling for midfield balance, why are we shoehorning a third midfielder in when actually we could just go proper traditional, go 4-4-2?
Makes too
Bellingham
much sense,
and Rice have got the capability to be a centre midfield pairing, particularly when you've got players that can step into midfield really easily. Stones, Trent, even Saka is so versatile that if you played him slightly deeper, he still covers a lot of ground. I think that works really, really well. So I would love to see him play together at some point, but he definitely did himself no harm in this game, did it? And also, just quickly, Grealish assist Ollie Watkins' goal. little tear in my eye, I'll be honest.
Maybe burning on that one.
I felt like that little, you know, that meme from Fast and Furious where Paul Walker's driving away from Vin Diesel. They like have one last look at each other like, oh, what could have been?
A bit of romance for you there in an otherwise dull game, I think. But staying on you, Miles, with that in mind, I mean, we've kind of touched on the fact that we don't think there'll be many changes from what we expect England to normally play against Italy. We don't expect any of the players really from the Australia game to play against Italy. But we've seen Italy as well win 4-0 against Malta and, you know, a convincing win. A win which included the likes of Matteo Darmian playing and Moise Kean as well. It was an interesting one. And Bonaventura scoring his first goal for Italy at the age of 34. So Italy are also full of surprises, it seems, at the moment too. So it's an interesting setup. But what can we expect of the game? Because there's a bit of trepidation for England now, isn't there? If they lose this game, it's suddenly looking very dangerous. The top spot looks like it could be fought out between those two teams. So what do you expect Italy to do in response to the way they played?
I'm confident that both of these teams will qualify. If you ask me now to pick a group winner, I think I might side with Italy. Wow. Simply because I've not been overly convinced by England in the last few fixtures. The Ukraine draw wasn't that inspiring. The Australia performance, I actually think Australia were the better side for some of the game as well. And this Italy team are now coached by Spalletti, which is huge. Like, Mancini did a very good job with Italy for the majority of his tenure, and they were really unfortunate not to make qualification last time out. But this time, yeah, you look at this squad and there's not a lot of weakness to it. Now, obviously, they're going to be missing a couple of players that we'll talk about shortly, and someone like Bonaventura found himself with an opportunity that he maybe wasn't expecting at 34, but has carried his Serie A form through. And then Domenico Berardi as well. He's been excellent at the start of this season, got himself two goals in this game. So when Italy have always kind of struggled to find a goal scoring forward, it's always good for him to step up. Even if it is a game against Malta, it's still form that you want to carry forward. So I would be quietly nervous as an England fan because I haven't seen enough to inspire me to think that they're ready for a bigger opposition. There's a lot on the line because I think top spot is huge when it comes to seeding in the tournament. And actually there's a lot of demons to fight in this one. Wembley fixture for the Euros against Italy. It's quite haunting, really, isn't it? But yeah, I don't know. I think Italy will fancy their chances. I think they'll have looked, I don't think they'll have seen much from England that inspires them to think that they can't go toe to toe with them. And this is a good Italy squad. And actually, I'd worry about that forward line and England's defence not really being that settled right now.
Well, that's a negative view. Blimey, I didn't expect you to think that negatively of Gareth Southgate's England. But I guess that's the mood that it creates when you start struggling to results against the likes of Australia in a friendly and a draw against Ukraine and add into it with the Jordan Henderson situation. Suddenly fans start feeling a little bit defeated, don't they already? So are you feeling that same way, Dave, do you reckon?
Just a reminder though as well, let's not forget we are missing a couple of players that I think make huge differences. Like Saka not being there, you cannot underestimate how huge that is for England. Like, it's funny because we thought we had so much talent in those wide positions. And then all of a sudden we've got a really out of form Rashford and no Saka. And it looks like a completely different conversation. I don't know.
Even with that drop off though, Dave, are you feeling nervous?
I'm more curious, to be honest, to see what he does with the team. Miles, so you mentioned there about obviously Saka's omission and obviously in the midfield is going to be the other one, really, to see what he does there and what he does to combat, obviously, arguably probably one of Italy's most, you know, strongest areas of the pitch, obviously in the midfield. I don't know if he's just going to, I think he'll play Foden off of the right. Just to get that element of control in the game, because he was obviously great at keeping hold of possession. And I think he'll play Rashford, but I don't think he should, because it's just not been good enough of late for club.
Who does come in?
I'd play Watkins off the left.
I'd love to see that, but it's not his position anymore.
No,
and actually, Emery's done a lot to take that away from his game. I wouldn't play him on the left, to be honest.
But because I think he'd offer a lot more balance than Rashford does. He's a lot better in his defensive side of his game. He's amazing in the press, works his socks off. I just feel like he'd offer a lot more balance to that team.
Madison, maybe?
Potentially, but...
Or Grealish.
He wasn't great. Grealish. Madison wasn't great in Australia. Well, no one was really, to be honest.
But, yeah.
It's just going to be interesting to see how he approaches it. I'm more curious than nervous, to be fair. I don't think we'll lose the game, but I'm not confident that we'll win either. It won't surprise me.
Yeah. It's a good shout.
That's about where I'll sit on it, to be fair.
Do you know what? I think Southgate would be happy with the draw as well. And that's another worrying thing.
I think it'll be an unconvincing draw.
Grab a point. Yeah, yeah. That's it. I think a point gives England the advantage going into this final round of games, doesn't it?
I think as well, you see what obviously Real Madrid have done with Bellingham since the start of the season. He's been playing obviously a lot more advanced role, and he's done absolutely outstanding in playing that role. But you can't really do that, obviously, with, for instance, if Kane's absent at any time, you can't really do that because you're taking so much out of that midfield, and his ability to drive the ball up the pitch, he's probably the only player we've got who can do that.
They'll barely use him for that.
Well,
I actually wouldn't be surprised to see Bellingham playing the kind of role he plays for Madrid, because it's likely that there'll be a double pivot behind him. It's like we'll see Henderson again in this game, if we're honest. Yeah. I think it would surprise me for Southgate to back down and take him out of the team for this one. I feel like he almost backed himself into a corner that he has to play him again. Well, otherwise, it looks like he's giving to the pressure.
I think you're right.
I think it'll be Rice.
I didn't want to say it, but I think Henderson's going to be starting along with Rice.
The only good thing about that is that might give Bellingham a bit of space to move forward and support Kane. And actually, that's quite perfect. Because if you have got Kane dropping deeper and Bellingham prepared to advance past him in the kind of form that he's in, that's an excellent asset to have.
Yeah.
I just wish it wasn't Henderson behind him.
Well, I think that's why he played Henderson against Australia, to kind of give him, I guess, some international level footballing experience, because he's been without that kind of practice, hasn't he, for a while. But I just remember that time when he played Henderson and Bellingham in the same starting 11. It might have been at the last tournament, to be fair, the World Cup. And Henderson was just chasing down and running after anything and everything. And it almost...
Yeah, it was terrible.
It almost ruined the balance between Bellingham being able to get forward. I just hope he gives him some very clear instructions about how to protect his defence and let Bellingham do his thing, because he's good enough now to do that, isn't he, Bellingham?
Do you know what? I think it highlights a big absence of, I think, certain midfielder that we need in there who can actually control a game as well.
Rice is that midfielder. And
I like Stones in there as well, to be fair. I think
absolutely.
Stones and Rice would be
Australia
good,
was the perfect game to probably bring a younger player in and give him an opportunity.
Who is that younger player?
Good question.
That's the only thing I would say.
For the under-21s, United bias aside, Angel Gomez. He's still having a great season.
Yeah, he's not going to play that deep though, is he?
he does operate a bit deeper, and he's shown he can play in that role. Obviously, there's a lot more players out than that, but I just felt like it's an opportunity to give somebody else an opportunity to give them a chance, and I don't feel like that's ever going to really happen while Southgate's at the club, to be honest.
Potentially. Well, it's not all sunshine and rainbows in the Italy camp either, is it, Miles? Because there's been some controversy there with Sandro Tonali and Nicolò Zaniolo both being sent home from the camp under investigation for using illegal betting websites as well. I don't know much about this story, but you've been reading into it. How much of a shadow does this cast over the Inter camp? And I mean, there's a question there really about just gambling in football generally, isn't there? Because it's not the first issue we've had with players and gambling generally, is it, over the last couple of years? But where does this leave Italy, and what do you know about the story?
So that's a good question. The second part of that question is a good one, because the answer is not much. And no one really knows much about it. It's still very up in the air. There's been a few contrasting reports that have come out, but let me caveat anything I say with, it's all very alleged at this stage and we don't know too much more. But I will give you a bit of a rundown on it because I think it's been quite underreported in England, which is a bit of a surprise when the two players involved both play their domestic football in England at the moment. So it's connected to a Juventus midfielder, a young Juventus midfielder, I think he's 22, Nicolo Fagioli, who has been under investigation as well for betting activity, has quite openly come out and said he has a gambling addiction and put himself forward for investigation after it kind of came out that there was some knowledge of this. In investigating that, supposedly there is communication between him and Sandro Tonali and him and Nicolò Zaniolo, where they talk quite openly about some of their betting activity. The only stumbling block I've got in terms of actual knowledge about this is the reports about the two players' involvements are massively different. So Tonali's camp have come out and suggested that Tonali himself has a gambling addiction as well. They've not commented on whether he's made any bets on football, particular games he's involved in. They've not said anything like that, but they have said that he has a gambling addiction as well. Whereas Zaniolo's camp have come out and outright denied it and said that there is no activity that's taken place with him. The only thing that he does is play online poker. And the issue comes around, supposedly, the sites and the companies that they've been using to do this are illegal companies registered by legal companies and domains, but then a separate platform to encourage activity from illegal users, which is a very complicated market that I don't know that much about. I'm not going to get that into. But it's a shame because, again, it clouds Italian football. And it feels like there's very often a scandal that clouds Italian football. It's not that far gone that we think about Calciopoli and the impact that had on Serie A in particular. And now we've got two players that have just achieved big moves to England, particularly in Tonali's case, where it's for huge amounts of money. And now they're wrapped up in something that could result in up to a 3-year ban. The punishment is much stricter in Italy than it is in England. So someone like Ivan Toney got 8 months. If I'm right, then if you are found to be guilty of betting on your own club, then it can be up to 5 years. And Zaniolo, the contrasting reports are, there are some reports saying that he not only made bets, but made bets on Roma games that he was playing in or on the bench for, which could be huge. Now, the repercussions for his club sides are a bit different there because he's only on loan at Aston Villa, but it's still huge for his career. And this is a young footballer who I'd be devastated to see caught up in something like that. And I think that opens up the wider conversation that we want to have a bit, Mike, isn't it? About where football and betting stand. We've talked about this before, obviously, because there's been a really big case in England with Ivan Toney. You've also had conversations, Mike, haven't you, about the impact that mental health within the game has on people. And addiction is a really serious part of that. And betting and gambling, I think a lot of people quite, I would say, ignorantly look at footballers betting and criticize them and say, you've got enough money, why'd you get involved in this? And actually, I think there's a wider conversation on how these addictive things can pretty much ruin lives. Like this young Juventus midfielder, there's talk that he was betting up to $100,000 in a couple of months. And he's not someone that's going to be on astronomical wages. And he's a young player and essentially could have written off a lot of his career now. So where do football and gambling sort of stand right now? And I don't know, I'm interested in what you two think about where football needs to be a bit stricter in these areas, personally.
I don't think it helps at all that every single other team has got a gambling outfit on their shirts as a sponsor. Mm. You know, billboards are filled with gambling sponsorships, and the amount of money coming into the game from gambling companies makes it almost hypocritical to even try and, you know, criticize players for being caught up in it, because they've got this toxic combination of having a heck of a lot of money, a lot of free time on the hands as well, quite often, because, you know, they're traveling long periods. They're usually either on their own or rooming with teammates, and they're bored. They need a rush. They need a kick. And I think from a mental health point of view, if they do put a bet on and it's an innocent bet and it comes through and it's quite a bit of money, it's a little side hustle for them. It's that extra kick they need in between match days. That's current players, and I think former players even more dangerous as well, because they miss the kick they get from match days and from the dressing room. They have still got some money. So when they have retired, it's an even bigger danger for ex-pros to get caught up with gambling as well, because you're still trying to find that rush and that kick, and you're still involved with the game. And, you know, you can see potentially how your knowledge could benefit you financially in that realm. And it's a dangerous combination, and there's no protection for players at all. And from a mental health point of view, you're right, Miles, it's seen as something that they should be above because they're on more money, but they're not doing it for financial gain necessarily. It's for a lot of other reasons. Mm. It's to fill a hole in their lives or something like that. And it's a difficult thing to kind of police as well, because they can do it whenever and wherever they want. Mm. And I guess you only really know somebody's struggling when they financially look like they're struggling as well, and it's hitting them hard. And for a professional football player in the Premier League, to see them struggling financially would be bloody hard, because they earn a lot of money. So it goes undetected for long periods.
Yeah, you're talking about young men who, the majority of them, don't really come from wealth, and all of a sudden are thrust into the limelight with excessive amounts of money they don't really know what to do with half the time.
Yeah.
And then the industry that they're in heavily promotes this activity, this pastime, this lifestyle. And then we're surprised when they buy into it. I just think it's mental. Yeah. Villa have got a betting sponsor on the front of their shirts this year. Like, they can't complain at Zaniolo for getting involved in it. Now, obviously, there is further moral scrutiny when it comes to, are you looking at match fixing? I think that's a completely different conversation then. And I also think that there's heavier levels of scrutiny for the fact that this is an illegal website that they're supposedly using, because what that then goes to fund and what that could inject into society can be really problematic, because a lot of the times these sites are geared up to support wider criminal operations that could be really dangerous. And it is irresponsible, but we are leading young men down a path. And women too in football now, that's kind of gaining more sponsorship traction as well. This is an industry that is taken over a global sport. And yet it feels like you kind of hang the players out to dry and chastise them for being involved in the exact thing you're trying to sell. I just find that a mental conversation. And now you've got three young professionals with a massive career ahead of them, integral to Italy's hopes at the Euros, for example, and really doing things in their football career that they're at new heights, it feels like. This is someone that was in a Champions League semi-final last year with Tonali and has just achieved a huge move to Newcastle. And his future feels under scrutiny now. If you've got a three-year ban, what do Newcastle do with an investment like that?
Yeah.
Like, it's difficult, isn't it? Is that the right answer for someone?
I think it's definitely, for instance, I think it's definitely desensitised the general public. I think they're definitely desensitised in terms of, they just think that players, obviously, have got a lot of money, their status that they carry, that they should know better. And for me, that's the wrong way to look at it. I think also you've got to explore sort of, you mentioned about maturity of these young people. That has a massive impact on decision making. But also, I suppose it almost feels like they're making an investment and they're investing their time into something that almost becomes a hobby. And there's a sense of reward there that when they obviously do win, and then you kind of raveled in almost a big routine where you're constantly, you know, pumping money in, losing it, getting it back. And it's so dangerous for me. And it's a massive thing, really, that needs to be looked at. And I feel like there needs to be more support there for players because it seems like there's an issue. You know, it's something that's dominating news more and more often. And
it's support more than anything, I think. And just financial advice generally, I don't think young footballers, when they're thrust into that much money quite soon, they're given that any advice at all, unless they've got a very astute agent. I think if they're surrounded by wrong-uns, like a few footballers are, then they can easily be led astray. And I think clubs have got a duty of care to protect young players, I think, from getting, you know, trapped in that kind of, I don't know, web of trouble, if you like. And that, you know, gambling's one of the lesser addictions, if you like, in terms of like being life-threatening. Like, you wouldn't know it's harming anybody physically.
I don't know, you know.
But mentally, it's one of the worst, you know.
I mean, it's bordering on it's a compulsion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For a lot of people.
And actually, the knock-on effects then of, like we talk about the mental health aspects, it is a really dangerous one. It is life-threatening for some people. It tears families apart.
And but what I mean is physically, you can't see somebody who's addicted to gambling.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I think it's difficult because then you have people like Ivan Toney who have been caught up in it in this country and then presents his case in a very different way in British press. And then it's kind of harder to understand. I don't want to be overly critical of him, but I feel like the conversation he had around his suspension didn't really give that much of an honest account of it. And actually that buries the problem slightly. And there's really contrasting reports coming out about what Zaniolo was saying. There's half of them that's completely denying it. And then there are reports saying that actually it's more serious with him and we'll never get to the bottom of those problems. And actually it's bigger than that individual. Mm. It really is. And it needs to be a bit of a wider conversation. So it's really sad to see. Italy have obviously sent both players home.
Yeah,
they say for their protection. And I actually think that's probably true as well, because the investigation is ongoing. They've been sent back to their clubs, but will have to appear in front of a magistrate at some point. Who knows where this will go, but it's one to keep an eye on, definitely, because we could be talking about really, really lengthy bans for two big names.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to have to shift the conversation onto something kind of almost as disappointing a conversation to talk about, really, Dave, and that's Manchester United and their takeover, which is a depressing state of affairs because there's no takeover happening, at least not a full takeover at this point, because Sheikh Jassim and the Qatari consortium have officially pulled out of any kind of bid. It seems like they were bidding against themselves for full ownership anyway, but the money they were offering, despite it being double what the club was worth, was still not enough for the Glazers, which says all you need to know about our current ownership. I mean, the table at the minute is a 25% stake in the club from Ineos Group, right? And so Jim Ratcliffe. I don't know what that means in terms of the club's ownership going forward and how much influence he's going to have. There's no guarantees for him as a businessman that he's going to get full ownership eventually, but I think he's been led with that kind of lure, isn't he? And it's just to get him to invest. But the money he's paying for 25% is ridiculous as well. So I think he's paying over the odds. It's a bit of a mess, Dave, isn't it? And it feels like the only people that are going to benefit from any of this are the Glazers once again.
Oh, they come out on top, don't they? That's the story of it, really. And I think it offers more questions than answers.
Yeah.
For me, there's so many questions, and that's almost scary, really, in a way. And I hope there's some transparency that's brought out about this. And apparently, there's a board meeting on Thursday about whether they're going to ratify the deal, and the board are going to vote on whether it's pushed through or not. And for me, I think the big question for me is whether that's going to eventually lead to a full takeover, which is ideally what needs to happen. The other thing for me that is crazy and almost unthinkable is I read today that he's not going to have a full handle on business decisions. Although there's going to be some things that I imagine will be put into place, obviously stipulations, and probably that he's obligated to have a buyout in the next 3 or 4 years, which you would think, because it would be unthinkable of a business and to punt all this money and investment into a club and see no return on it. Not just obviously on the business side, but on the sporting side. What is also strange is that he's apparently going to have football in hands-on management, even though he owns 25%. I mean, that says a lot to me about the Glazers more than anything, is that they are happy for that to happen. But it also says to me a lot about their standing in the club and how they have, it tells a lot about how they've actually, you know, managed the club from the beginning, to be honest. Almost. Yeah. It feels like they're fed up. It feels like they've had enough. And that's clear to me because they want a way out, but they want a way out getting, maximising the profits from the club and maximising the funds that they're going to get from the club. And that's there for all to see, is that it seems as though, obviously, Qatar were the only all in. They wanted the club 100%. And it almost seems like the Glazers want an involvement in the club without having to do a lot, basically. And they want to be making money off of it. And that's the sad thing for me.
The 25% ownership, conceding that would give them that as well, wouldn't it? To give them somebody to trot out and make a scapegoat as well, because they're the ones making the decisions. But I think for fans, it's just more uncertainty that bothers me. Like you say, the amount of questions this raises about the future of the club. How long are we talking before they're looking for a full sell? Like a year, 10 years? It could be a decade of the same old stuff, couldn't it?
If he's only managing the footballing side, but then he's only got a 25% stake in the business, then how do you agree on investment funds? Mm-hmm. Because the money's still the money's still going to be coming from the club and should be coming from the owners, which is still the Glazers. So
well, look what happened at Arsenal when they had, you know, joint ownership and more than one billionaire trying to run the club. It was a disaster, wasn't it? And I feel that's going to be the case. It's just a clash of egos and just more uncertainty. I mean, from an outsider looking in, Miles, I mean, you've made it quite clear about United and the state of the club and, you know, how you feel for us. And you look at what could have been, which would be a Qatari takeover. And I still feel incredibly uneasy about the thought of that as well, for various other reasons, as we know. But what's your take on the situation now, where that's now no longer an option, but this weird halfway house is the next step?
I think the Glazers have done a phenomenal business job. If I'm totally honest with you both. And I think that's the sad reality. If we treat this as what it is, a business to them, let's be honest, they've got no compassionate connection to the club or the fans. It's not a footballing project for them. It is a business. It's a business that they purchased for just under £800 million. And they're about to sell a quarter of it for £1.7
billion. Yeah.
So it's phenomenal business to them because they're doing all the things you've just said. They're keeping someone on board that can be a scapegoat for the problems and giving him the football side, which means that it's all the front-facing things. So any issues will be a problem. That opens up so many questions to me, because where do you draw the line? What becomes a footballing decision? Because spending 250 million on players to improve a squad sounds like a footballing decision, but it's very clearly a business decision, because where do you get that money from? So it's such a weird thing to define as part of a football club. But the Qatari bid to me was a bizarre one in the first place, because the Glazers didn't want to sell the whole club. Qatar were trying to sell this passion project of, this is what we're going to turn Man United into. But why would the Glazers care? Mm-hmm. Once they've sold and they get nothing from it, they don't want that. They don't care. All that will do is kind of raise the profile of an asset that they used to have. They want to keep hold of the asset. And right now what they've done is they're going to get a massive injection of cash. They can continue to let Man United kind of be almost self-sufficient and pay for itself while they kind of tick over in the background and bring in the profits. Let Jim Ratcliffe kind of promote it as his passion project, because supposedly I think his son's a massive Man United fan, and this is more about a project for him rather than a business decision. So you've got someone who is going to do all your dirty work for you. I think it's an excellent bit of business from the Glazers, but it doesn't put Man United in an any more favourable position. No. And that doesn't surprise me at all. It's just, you're right when you mention Arsenal as a comparison, because the lack of certainty that's going to follow Man United after this is huge, because I really can't get my head around how the Glazers view a football club as anything other than a business commodity, when they're saying things like, you can run our football division of Manchester United Football Club.
Yeah.
That is the only division.
Like that's a small fraction of it.
Yeah. The commercial decisions you make are huge, but they are there in theory to elevate the football club. That's what it has always been, but it's not to them. And why should it be at this point? Because they don't get love from the fans, but what they do get is money. And realistically, any other business in the world operates that way. So why are we surprised that a footballing club that is arguably one of the biggest in the world is going to operate in the same way?
You were talking about what a footballing decision would be, and I think stadium and infrastructure as well kind of falls under that.
Is that real estate?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a big one. And that's a big one that the fans want resolving as soon as possible. And I honestly think this part ownership is going to set United back another decade. I really do. It's not looking pretty, Dave, is it? But I know the Man United Supporters Trust are kind of driving hard looking for answers. Good luck to them. I really hope they get some, and I really hope they dig in deep to kind of get what they need. And I think as United fans, I'm keen to know what you think, Dave. What do we do? How can we protest? How can we hit the Glazers where it hurts? What's the solution here for us? Because it's a helpless situation otherwise, isn't it?
I think the only way that they'd make a difference would be to protest in the form of not turning up to games. Mm. And the reality of that is not going to happen, sad as it is. So there's nothing we can do. That's the reality. There's nothing we can do as fans, unless it's the extremes of empty stadiums in games, which won't happen because of obviously the massive fan base that the club's got internationally.
The massive soft fan base as well. Yeah. Because the core of Man United fans could easily organise some sort of walkout or a lack of attendance, but you do just open the doors then to people that wouldn't otherwise get an opportunity to see Man United and aren't invested in the way that like you two are, for example, or season ticket holders are. Like, it's two. They're bigger than the problem, Man United. That's the fundamentals of it.
They'll always fill the seats, won't they?
Empty stadiums and protests that big that games get called off. That's it. That's the only way that anything
but then you've got the balance
change.
Of disrupting the squad and the team and results on the pitch. I mean, do we want the team to get relegated in a sense just to kind of prove a point?
For long-term gain, I'd happily see United get relegated if the Glazers left. And we had some coming in full takeover. I'd actually, because we've suffered that. It sounds ridiculous because I think obviously supporting the club from a very young age, you used to obviously see and winning, you know, week after week, there's that mentality of winning and the history of it all. And I think it actually, for instance, watching the Beckham documentary actually made me realise what this club is all about. And it's not all about that anymore. The sad reality, really, especially when you see what the club's been through. And I'd be happy to take a hit, to be honest. You look at Juventus, they went down for a number of years. Rangers, they've come back from it. These clubs do come back from these, you know, these downturns in these bad years that they have. And I've just had enough of it, really.
Quick question for you both, if you don't mind. Is this better than nothing? Because there is another view of it that actually Ratcliffe's been really smart.
Nothing.
And once he's in, it might be easier for him to take full control and deal with the Glazers long term. It's not going to happen in the short term. Is it good to say that it's at least one step in the right direction? It might not be the whole journey, but you'd probably rather, if we're honest, have Jim Ratcliffe than the Qatari bid, right? And you've now got to a point where a quarter of that job is done. Is that better than nothing? Is there something to be positive about?
No, because I don't think, I mean, that's implying that you can trust the Glazers to then foresee, you know, a sale of the club, a full sale of the club eventually. I don't think that's in their plan. I really don't. You know, I think as long as United is the cash cow that it is to them, they'll just keep stringing him along. And I hope he's got some kind of deal in place, just for Jim Ratcliffe to say, this is what I expect by this length of time, just so, you know,
he's a very smart man. I'd be surprised if he didn't.
Yeah. I mean, we won't ever know that until it actually comes to fruition, but I just don't trust them as far as I can throw them. And I don't know how he's getting into bed with them, to be honest, because that just makes him look worse.
I think until we know a little bit more about, obviously, what's going to happen. But for me, if nothing were to happen, if both parties, obviously, you know, Qataris have pulled out, if Ratcliffe was to pull out as well, the Glazers are in a corner, really, because the way the club's being ran at the minute, if you look at the, you know, the balance books, the finances, it's not sustainable. So they have to do something. They would have to do something in the next 2 years because the club
has
been ran into the ground. Well, yeah.
But they've done it. They've just brought in 1.7 billion by the looks of things. That's just crazy. And the thing I really want to know is, what do you do between the two of them? So let's say the first thing Ratcliffe says is, I want to renovate Old Trafford. I want to expand the stadium. I want to make it the best stadium in England. Does he put 25% of the money down? Because then you're still asking the Glazers for the rest. And they'll say no. So if Ratcliffe doesn't have a controlling stake, what's the point in 25% of Man United right now? Because at the end of the day, he's not going to be a decision maker. The board will still come back and knock back any of the things that they want to do that's going to cost the Glazers anything. All right, they've got a quarter of the price off now, but they've made it very clear they don't want to put too much in and into the bigger things. They might invest in players here and there and they'll spend 80 million on Antony. But when it comes to the things that are actually going to improve the infrastructure, they've really held back for some reason. Yeah. And I don't understand how someone else being involved changes that.
Well, listeners, if you're new to the pod, I'll be honest, this is not as negative as we normally are. It's normally a lot more positive than this. But that's all we've got.
Because we get to talk about Villa. When they're back, we'll be positive again.
It feels like it's a rare glimmer of hope when we talk about your boys, mate, honestly. But please don't let that deter you. Hop over to our YouTube channel and subscribe over there. Help us continue our growth generally. We'd really appreciate that. But until then, Miles, over and out. And Dave, more than ever, Glazers out. See you later.
See you next time.